Happy fall. I wanted to give a quick disclaimer, as I usually do, about the poor quality of this podcast and let you know that I am ill. So my voice is a little more annoying than usual and it's raspy. So don't adjust your audio settings. It's my voice. I am going to jump right into this case because I, on my temporary setup, only have 30 minutes of record time. So tonight we're going to talk about Randy Trimble. And in 2002, 25-year-old computer technician Blaine Norris was trying to break onto the low-budget indie movie scene following the Blair Witch Project's success. I'm assuming that anyone listening to this podcast knows about the Blair Witch Project, but just to make sure, it was a documentary style movie that was to be based on lost hikers who were out hunting for the Blair Witch. The hikers don't turn up, but their footage does over a year later. And it's purely fiction, but it's made to look real, like all this recovered footage point of view. So Blaine has an idea to shoot the movie about a group of hikers being haunted and murdered in the Appalachian woods by the ghost of a coal miner who had been murdered himself 100 years before. He sets out with this small hometown paper, ad casting calls, and soon he had collected a group of amateur actors, with the exception of Robin Griggs. She had previous acting experience in the soap opera Another World. Blaine asked his Harrisburg, Pennsylvania insurance company coworker if he would like to be involved as cameraman. Brian Trimble, a fellow computer technician at Capital Blue Cross, offered up his personal camera equipment and services. He was into photography, but he was no professional aside from shooting a couple of weddings. In fact, once he was on board, he took a few headshots of the cast members for the movie's website. But the shots were so poorly done that Sam, I believe it's Wolnick. Side note, I watched this documentary called Rough Cut, and they tended to put the person's name on the screen who was speaking, but they didn't say the name. So if I mispronounced your name, Sam, if you ever heard this, I apologize. But he was a friend of Robin's and had backed thousands of dollars toward Blaine's film. But he got nervous when he saw the headshots, and even more so because Brian Trimble had recently been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and it left him unable to hike the trails and be in the elements for days at a time, which would have been required. And as cinematographer, that posed a pretty huge problem. In fact, the cast states that they never saw Brian or his equipment at any auditions or rehearsals. Blaine told Sam when Sam came to complain that he basically had two options. He could either give him his money back, or Sam could chill and just let Blaine do everything the way that he wanted to do it. Sam ultimately pulled his investment, which I think a lot of us, could understand why. Producing even a low budget film takes pretty big bucks, and Blaine had zero of those. Blair Witch Project was shot on a budget between $35,000 to $60,000, but the actual total cost after post production stuff, whatever they do, I don't actually know anything about movie making. What I do know was learned from James Vanderbeek as Dawson Leary between the years of 1998 and 2000. So anyway, the total cost was hundreds of thousands of dollars when they finished post-production. Blaine had $0, zero investors, and zero professional actors involved now because Robin wound up breaking her arm. Blaine ended up footing the production bill on his credit card and quickly racked up around. I should just leave that in. I'm gonna leave it in. $18,000 he quickly racked up. Later that summer, Blaine tells the cast that his wife left him and he moves into a Harrisburg apartment of Ryan Baker, which was Thru Hike's sound technician. The last scene is shot in October of 2002, but editing is going very slowly. He sends emails to the cast members and they assume that he has a lot of personal things going on in his life, with his wife leaving him and a pending divorce. We're going to travel back just a little bit to 1974 when Nancy Chavez was 19 and married to a man named Gary Peck. This was a man that turned out to be very abusive shortly after their wedding, and Nancy quickly found out something else after their marriage. She was pregnant. On December 15th, 1974, Randy Lee Peck was born. For 7.5 years, Nancy Chavez endured the abuse of her husband and was too afraid to take her daughter and leave, as her husband had threatened to kill her. She would cover the bruises and hide her abuse from everyone, including her family. Her parents were pretty disapproving of Nancy's marriage, and she didn't want to admit to them that her husband was abusive. At 25 years old, though, Nancy thought about her daughter and how she deserved a better life. So Nancy took Randy and she left and moved in with her sister. Nancy began working 2 to 3 jobs and working over the weekends to save money for Randy's education. Nancy went back to school at night and eventually obtained her master's degree after 15 years, doing her schoolwork at the kitchen table right alongside her daughter. Despite leaving and building a new life, Nancy was still afraid of the man that she had married. And it was important to Nancy for Randy to have all of the same opportunities that Nancy had had as a child. So when Randy was little, she enjoyed tap dancing and tumbling. She liked playing her flute, and she had a cherished Winnie the Pooh collection. Nancy said that Randy loved musicals, and when she sang the song Best Friends from the movie Beaches, she would cry. Side note, if you've never seen that movie with Bette Midler, like, you have to go now and watch it. Pause this podcast and go watch it and then come back. In high school, Randy excelled in her studies and her love of music continued to grow, and she started her journey to becoming a drum major. She attended Pennsylvania's Bloomsburg University, majoring in speech pathology. She went on to become a drum major in the Bloomsburg Band and received a full academic scholarship for their graduate program. She was holding a GPA of, I believe, 3.8. And before her senior year, Randy applied for a job at the New Cumberland Army Depot's daycare center. It was there that she met fellow applicant Brian Trimble. Both Randy and Brian got a position and spent their entire summer getting to know one another while toting around toddlers to the pool, and they began dating. About 2 years into the relationship, Brian proposed. Randy was busy with her education, but over the next 3 years, she planned her wedding with Brian. As her wedding date crept closer, Randy, the speech therapist, began noticing some changes with Brian, namely that he was starting to slur his words. After his MS diagnosis, Nancy had asked Randy to really consider her future and if she still wanted to marry Brian. According to a 2010 Harrisburg Magazine article, Randy's answer was, "Mom, I can't do that. I love this man. I wouldn't want him to do this to me. I'll stay with him. This is what my life will be devoted to, him and my children." So on September 9th, 2000, Randy Peck became Randy Trimble. Randy and Brian's home was located about 3 blocks away from Nancy's home, and despite his increase in symptoms, Brian continued to work at the insurance company, and Randy had landed a speech language pathologist position. It's a good thing I'm not one of those, at Hershey Medical Center within their Department of Neurorehabilitation. I'm struggling. Things were seemingly wonderful, and Randy and Brian were even talking about having a baby. I want to let you guys know I will no longer edit anything out for the rest of this episode because this is my second time recording it, and it's past my bedtime, and I'm tired, and I know that my mouth sounds like mush, and I don't care, okay? Randy's story is important to tell, and I'm just going to do it and power through. That's been your notice. Because their home was so near to Nancy's home, and Randy and Nancy were already very close, all three of them spent a lot of time together, and they would have dinner at each other's homes quite often. One night, Brian comes home from work, and Nancy's there for dinner, and he starts telling them how his friend at work wants to produce and direct a movie, very Blair Witch Project-esque. He goes on to say that the producer had asked everyone involved in the movie to put up $5,000 toward the cost of production. Now, Randy, as the person who had been working 2 jobs and purchased their home and was essentially padding savings for their future, understandably said no. Like they were talking about having a baby and who knows what future costs could arise with Brian's medical issues. So she was like, let's be adults here. And this is just another quick side note that a very recent study, I found the results of this study posted on October 11th of this year. Scientists in Sweden and the UK found that there might be a link between having mono as a teen and then later being diagnosed with MS after age 20. So I just found that interesting. A little anxiety inducing also, as someone who has the Epstein-Barr virus just laying around dormant inside her body. I feel like a lot of us might though. So, you know, you can have a little bit of anxiety with me. Anyway, Brian, who had typically talked about his marriage in a positive light, according to coworker Tracy Thompson, who had sat at a desk across from him, began complaining about his controlling wife. "My cat's eating. Again, not editing out. It is what it is. Love me." It seemed that Randy had mainly handled their finances, and sometimes Brian would have to call and obtain permission to make an ATM withdrawal so he could, like, go out to lunch with his coworkers. And these complaints grew into his announcement to Tracy that he would ask Randy for a divorce over Christmas 2002. When Tracy asked Brian why, he told her that things just weren't what they used to be, and then just as suddenly, he told her that they were going to work on their marriage. Nancy left for a cruise on Sunday, January 5th, 2003, and cruises were actually something that Nancy and Randy had enjoyed together and independently of each other. In fact, Randy and Brian were planning a 2003 cruise of their own. The day before Nancy left for her cruise, she was with Randy, who was showing off this new china she had received as a Christmas gift and was telling Nancy where she was going to put it. That exchange was the last time that Nancy would ever see Randy alive. She spoke to Randy on the phone while she was on her cruise, a conversation that lasted about 15 minutes on Thursday, January 9th, around noon, and it made both Randy and Nancy more comfortable because days had passed without them speaking, which was highly unusual. I believe they spoke every day, multiple times a day, almost always. On Friday, January 10th, 2003, Brian was having dinner with a friend at the Park City Center TGI Fridays in Lancaster, which was about 40 minutes away from the Cumberland County home that he shared with Randy. Nancy had dinner plans of her own that evening, but at the last minute, she opted for staying in her room. Like, for some reason, she just didn't feel like herself and didn't want to go down to dinner. Upon his return home, Brian found Randy in their garage, face down and bleeding. At 8:29 p.m., he called 911, sounding on the verge of hysterics. He was breathing heavily while describing this shocking scene of finding his wife, and eventually starts breaking down into these sobbing answers and pleas for help to the dispatcher. Coroner Michael Norris gave a grim account of Randy's final moments. She had approximately 27 stab wounds, which were front and rear, defensive wounds on her hands, and evidence of strangling, which investigators determined was caused by a Christmas decoration electrical cord that the killer had used as a garrote. East Pennsboro police detectives report that when they arrived on scene, the amount of blood covering her head and matting her hair would have made it nearly impossible to determine if the victim was male or female just by looking at the body, had it not already been known that she was female. A forensic pathologist determined that the stab wounds were caused by a knife of approximately 6 inches in length. Detective Chip Dougherty, I want to stop really quickly and say that it's spelled like Dougherty, but in the documentary Rough Cut, the only person who says his name says it as Dougherty, so that's what I'm going with. But Detective Dougherty said that by the time he reached the third room inside the Trimble home, he got the feeling that the scene was staged, and he actually thought to himself, "This looks like a movie set. CDs and DVDs were pulled down and strewn about. Closets were emptied. Purses were pulled out, but they weren't gone through. The cabinets under the sinks had their cleaning supplies pulled out. It was just a bunch of mess with no real ransacking occurring. Just the illusion that it had been ransacked." Detective Dougherty had interviewed Brian about 3 to 4 times, but weeks after Randy's murder, he tells Brian that he would like to get a walkthrough of the scene videotaped. And it's at this time that Brian explains to Detective Les Freeling with Detective Kurt, I believe it's Wagenrieder. I'm sorry, Kurt, if I said that incorrectly. But Kurt is videotaping, and Brian tells them at this time that he comes into the garage and finds Randy and kneels down to touch her. During his previous interviews with Kurt and Detective Dougherty, Brian stated that he had never went into the garage and never touched his wife. So that raised a little bit of suspicion with Detective Dougherty, who starts making unannounced visits to Brian. And on one particular visit, he told Brian he would love to have a TV, like the new one that he noticed that Brian had just purchased, but his wife would never let him. And according to Detective Dougherty, Brian's response was, quote, "Yeah, my wife wouldn't let me have it either." Brian quickly blew through money furnishing his new apartment with that TV, stereo equipment, theater equipment, et cetera, just high ticket items. And District Attorney Skip Ebert said they began learning about his sexual encounters, one of which was with his stepsister. So detectives describe Ryan as acting more like a college student, sleeping around with literally anyone, as I just mentioned, rather than, you know, the standard grieving husband just a couple of months after his wife's murder. Now, after his quote unquote odd behavior and several inconsistencies that he had given during multiple discussions over the months following Randy's murder, investigators interviewed Brian on May 8th, 2003. And at that time, Brian asked if his mother could be present. Shortly after the interview began, Brian asked his mother to leave the room. Detective Freeling told Brian, "You didn't kill your wife, did you?" And Brian answered, "No." The investigator said, "But you planned it, didn't you?" And Brian answered, "Yes," explaining that Blaine Norris was Randy's murderer. Brian went on to say that as he was complaining more frequently to Blaine about Randy during the time that Blaine was writing the script for Through Hike, he jokingly said, "Well, you could just kill her." And as Brian approached the consideration of divorce, Blaine said, "Well, you know, when I said that you could just kill her, I was half serious." And Brian, poor little Brian, was just tired of his wife. Like, he was simply tired of Randy controlling him, according to him. So he was like, "You know what? We're not getting along very well. I'm tired of her controlling ways, but I could never put her through the pain of a divorce because I don't want to hurt her or her family." Yes, that is actually what he told investigators. So he was like, "What you thinking, Blaine?" And then these two absolute dork-ass nerds began to plan Randy's murder. Blaine would carry out the murder because Brian was literally a baby back bitch, and he would pay Blaine a sum of $20,000, which would conveniently cover the credit card debt that he had racked up producing the movie that Randy wouldn't allow Brian to participate in. According to Nancy, a divorce would have been just completely out of left field. Randy would have been blindsided because she was actively trying to get pregnant beginning in April 2002 up until the very last day of her life. At the time of his arrest in May, Brian had about $4 remaining of the roughly $25,000 he had when Randy had died in January. Blaine Norris was not on anyone's radar aside from Tracy Thompson's. In fact, at Randy's funeral, Blaine had been lurking among several other Blue Cross employees who came to pay their respects. Nancy gave all of them hugs, Blaine included, and told them to keep Brian busy and take care of him. Detective Joe Landis had previously interviewed Blaine at Blue Cross, mainly to learn more information about Brian. And Blaine told the detective that he and Brian had a Dungeons and Dragons game scheduled that Friday, the night of Randy's murder, but the game was canceled because Brian had other plans. When detectives interviewed other colleagues, Tracy did not hesitate in telling them that she knew right away Brian had killed his wife once she heard the news. And furthermore, she believed that he had hired someone to help him, and that someone being Blaine Norris. Did it help that these two computer geniuses thought that it would be no big deal if Brian used his computer to send Blaine a link to a website called hitman.com 8 days before Randy was murdered? Yes, it helped authorities. Absolutely. So they've got the killer named, but the trouble was proving it because there was essentially no trace at the scene. While Blaine is being driven home one day by friends because he was busy getting a vasectomy and couldn't drive himself home, the police are there with a warrant to search his apartment. So they pull up and they're like, "Hey, buddy, we're here to search your apartment." And Blaine's like, "I would like to get some ice for my post-op." And they were like, "We truly don't care." So his friends got him some frozen peas. And Blaine sits on the back steps of his apartment building atop said frozen peas and really didn't seem too concerned. And he later emailed his cast members and he was like, "Listen, editing of Through Hike is about 90% complete. However, the police just came and confiscated my computer and all the footage." And he tells them that he hopes the authorities would release the property sooner rather than later, and then they could shift their investigation towards something that would lead them in the right direction, because obviously they had it wrong and he wasn't involved. Now, during the search of Blaine's apartment, authorities found handguns, rifles, hunting knives, but nothing that had been used in the brutal attack on Randy. They discovered books on forensics. I'm not going to generally judge anyone for having those, like, at all. I think anyone listening to this podcast probably doesn't think that's strange at all. But in one particular book, Blaine had highlighted sections on how to mask forensic evidence. So with no compelling evidence located inside the apartment, detectives moved to Blaine's vehicle, and it was there that they found a Lancaster Kmart receipt, and that confirmed the purchase of surgical gloves, work gloves, a hooded sweatshirt, and a pair of sweatpants. Detective Dougherty asked the store manager to verify if any other items had been purchased on that day using that same credit card, and guess what he freaking said? A 6-inch fillet knife. There were still problems, though, because no murder weapon had yet to be found. And Blaine Norris had an alibi. Blaine had a friend named Dan, and I'm not going to say his last name because I want to talk badly about him. When I tell you that there is a clip of Dan in that documentary, Rough Cut, where he describes how he and Blaine used to go out to bars, and Blaine would try to get Dan to hit on, quote, coming directly from Dan's mouth, the fat, ugly waitresses. I hope that you watch this documentary, but if you don't, he looks like a less attractive version of the centaur in Harry Potter with, like, costume size ears. They're massive. So, sir, please check yourself in your wording. Like, I'm not gonna hate on anyone's appearance. I don't have any room to do so. But when you get on a documentary and you laughingly joke about hitting on, quote, fat, ugly waitresses, like, please go look at this man. That's all I'm going to say. Anyway, Dan tells the police that he and other friends had seen Blaine outside of his apartment on the night of Randy's murder between 7:15 and 7:30 p.m., which would have been the time that everything was occurring. It turns out, though, authorities verified Dan had the timing off. He was wrong by like an hour because they reviewed surveillance footage from a gas station that Dan had told them they stopped at, and it was more like 8:30. So that would have given Blaine plenty of time to commit the crime and then get back to the area where they saw him. When investigators knocked on Blaine's door in September 2003 and advised him that he was under arrest for murder, big tough guy Blaine Norris fainted. Like a real, true, legitimate, got pale and sweaty and like fell over. They had to hold him up from falling over, I believe they said in the documentary. In his infinite wisdom, he had outlined his own alibi on the now confiscated computer, and he actually typed out with his disgusting little maggot fingers, quote, ugh, watched a pornographic DVD on my computer, masturbated, finished around 6 p.m., listen to me when I tell you, seeing the words finished on my screen produced a gag. Like, I cannot. He also drafted his own defense questioning scenario for Ryan Baker and a cross-examination for officers. Lol. He wrote letters to his parents, wife, girlfriend, cast and crew members of Through Hike, like all these in advance letters in the event that he was either arrested or missing or dead. And he wrote one to Brian saying, quote, no hard feelings about this whole thing. It's not your fault I've gotten the royal screw job. And then he asked Brian to send some money to his son. He wrote a fake letter to police calling them bumpkins and saying that they would never find who the killer of Randy was. He signed it Trooper. And if you're like, who? Big Trooper, huh? No one knows for sure why he used that signature, but they did find Pennsylvania State Trooper applications in his desk when they were searching his apartment. In April of 2004, Blaine pleaded guilty, avoiding trial and the death penalty because he's such a tough guy. He told Nancy, prepare yourselves. He told Nancy, quote, I wish I could give you more than an apology. I wish I could give you your daughter back. If by forfeiture of my life, I could bring her back to you, I'd lay down my life without hesitation. No, you wouldn't. Blaine, you would not. And that's more disgusting to tell Randy's mother that than like your pathetic jerk off timeline. It really it grinds my gears. Blaine. Blaine told investigators the night of the murder that Randy pulled her vehicle into the garage, and once the garage door was closed and she opened the interior door that led to their dining room, Blaine attacked her, taking her down to the ground from the back. He attempted to strangle her but wasn't able to, so he repeatedly smashed her head into the concrete of the garage floor. She begged for him just to take her money. He pulled out his knife and began to stab her for a total of 27 times. At the very end of Randy Trimble's life, she was praying and asking God for forgiveness for any sins that she may have committed. So I'm going to, right here, I'm going to say, Blaine, if you ever had the ability to think that you could apologize and say, I wish I could bring her back, you wouldn't have stabbed her 27 times. This woman was praying to God and asking for forgiveness for her sins, anything that she may have done. You're disgusting. In the 2010 Harrisburg article that I mentioned earlier, Nancy said at first that she believed, that Randy's father was her killer because after all these years, still she was scared of him. In Randy's obituary, it was requested that any memorial contributions be made to the MS Society Central Pennsylvania chapter. And hauntingly, someone described within their condolences that, quote, though I never knew Randy on a personal basis, while working with Brian at Earthlink, he raved about how awesome she was. You definitely saw the sparkle in his eyes when he talked about her. My prayers are with Brian and Randy's family. Nancy and her family were devastated and heartbroken that not only had they lost Randy, but they lost her to a person that she had loved so hard and that they had loved so much, but they realized they had never really known this person at all. So, you know, they were losing two people, essentially. But Nancy has worked tirelessly to keep Randy's memory alive and morph this horrific, just senseless and needless tragedy into a way to help others. In 2005, on Mother's Day weekend, actually, she began Randy's Race for Hope and Courage, which is a 5K that has raised over $500,000. On the Randy's House of Angels website, it's noted that the funds raised support programs for children, including Randy's Kids Club. This is a 10-week therapeutic group for children ages 8 to 13. There's also Randy's Camp, which is a 3-day interactive summer camp. Randy's Clubhouse, an interactive therapeutic group for children ages 5 to 7. And it just blends like emotional and art therapy and, you know, all these things gently and kindly and playful interactions for kids. Over $275,000 has been donated to agencies and organizations that support programs for children of crime and domestic violence. And there is also Randy's teen group and a support group called Restoring Our Souls. That particular group includes surviving family members and close friends of victims, and it helps them cope with their grieving. Members also serve as a resource to the Cumberland County DA's office to develop a uniform protocol and how to respond to the needs of victims of crime. There's more stuff on the website. Like, they have a golf outing and there's a backstory about Randy and there's some really nice pictures of her when she was younger and her with Nancy. So I recommend everybody check it out. It's randyshouseofangels.org. Randy is spelled with an I. So it's RANDIS, houseofangels.org. There was an American Monster, I believe, is the show. I was actually just talking about this and I forgot to look it up. It doesn't matter though, because I don't want you to watch it. And here's why. Nancy, was talking about this particular, show, and she was really adamant about it not being aired. And she said, quote, quit giving the perpetrators notoriety, infamy, and the attention they crave. Spend more time on the unlikely victims, like my daughter, and how surviving families have taken something so tragic and helped others. And when I was first looking into this, because I saw that episode, that's what I saw months ago, and it's been in my mind, and I was reading more about it, and I watched a couple of other things, and I watched the documentary, And at first I was like, oh my gosh, I can't tell this story because I read that quote from Nancy. And then I was like, you know what? Nancy has done so much good once I went to the website and I was reading about everything. And I wanted to make sure that people remembered Randy, just as Nancy is trying to do. So, you know, if you're in the area and you need those resources, go to that website. You know, you never know who this might reach and what kind of positive impact it could make. And I want to end on kind of a sweeter note from Nancy about Randy. And she said, I love saying that Randy was my life and that she will always be my life. That's how I wanted it. I feel very, very proud that I was her mom. So I'm not going to plug the things that I usually do because, one, they're not ready, and because I'm sad. That quote makes me sad. So I don't want to morph into telling you to go do things. But I do want to say thank you for listening to my refrigerator and my cat and my dog and my raspy voice and all of that stuff. So I love you so much. Bye.